I think since a hush is descending on the room that we could start. My name's Anthony Giddens. I'm director of the LSE. Can I welcome everyone here to this debate this evening on behalf of the LSE and Flemings? This debate is on the future of European monetary integration. We have one principal speaker and four discussants. Could I first of all introduce our distinguished speaker? Alexander Lamfalussy was born in Hungary. He became a Belgian citizen after leaving his native country in 1949. From 1949 to 1953, he studied at the University of Leuven in Belgium. After this, he spent 2 years on postgraduate studies at Nuffield College, actually at Oxford in this country. From 1955 to 1965, he worked with the Banque de Bruxelles, initially as an economist and then as economic advisor. He obtained a doctorate in economics from Oxford and lectured at Yale University in the early 1960s. Later on, in the 1960s and mid-1970s, Mr. Lamfalussy served first as executive director of the Banque de Bruxelles and later chairman of the executive board. Between 1965 and 1975, he lectured at the University of Leuven and was appointed professor at this university in the mid-1970s. He then joined the Bank for International Settlements at Bâle as economic advisor and head of the Monetary and Economic Department towards the end of the 1970s. He, in the early 90s, had conferred on him the title of Baron, but I hope he won't mind me referring to him as Mr.
Your message, so the only thing I'm asking is not to call me by all my possible titles, which is the German habit, you see, where you are doctor, professor, Mr. and Baron at the same time.
Well, the English preferences for a much more informal mode of approach, so I hope we can stick to the one term. Just to finish, since January 1994, Mr. Lamfalussy has been president of the European Monetary Institute. He is opening the proceedings tonight with a short lecture, which will then be discussed by the other participants here. The title of the lecture is Securing the Benefits of EMU. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I have my lecture written out, is at your disposal after my presentation, and I'll try to sum it up because it's a little too long, but you can read it afterwards if you wish to read it. Now, what I'm trying to do tonight is to tell you how I look at the benefits of EMU. Its potential costs, a sort of cost-benefit analysis, and basically to tell you what I think we should do in order to minimize the potential costs and to maximize its potential benefits. Now, before doing that, however, just a few words about the EMI. The EMI is a rather peculiar institution. This was set up at the beginning of 1994. And it's going to disappear once the European Central Bank is established, sometime, I would say, in the second quarter of 98. The institution is run by its council. Its members are the 15 central bank governors plus myself, and we have now a staff of around 250, which is gradually built up to the level of around 400-500 by the middle of next year, which will mean that the European Central Bank will be able to operate initially at least with... Yes. Well, I tried to...
You could take the microphone out if you want. Is it not working?
Do you hear now?
Yes,
it's better? Okay, all right. Well, I'll do this in this way. Now, so the EMI is operating with a staff of about 250, and we have a number of tasks. We have a current task, which is to coordinate monetary policies. I'm not going to talk about it at this stage. We have an advisory function, which is an important one. I'll come back to that in a minute, which is to advise the governments about the eligibility of the countries for entering into monetary union. And then we have a function which deserves, I think, 2 minutes of a presentation, which is the actual preparation of the European Central Bank and of the Monetary Union. And what we have to do is to make sure that when the European Central Banking Council meets the first time in its capacity as decision maker for monetary policy at the beginning of 99, that it will be in a position to set the first central bank rate in euro for the whole euro area. Now, this requires a number of a considerable amount of preparatory work in all the key areas of central banking, the establishment of the monetary policy instruments, of the monetary policy strategy, the interlinking of the payment systems, the harmonization of the accounting schemes, preparation of the banknotes, foreign exchange reserve management, and so on and so forth. What I can tell you is that we are on track. We have a very tight timetable. We work under a considerable constraint, and for each of our EMI council, we have our agenda until the last probable council meeting sometime in the spring of 98, and so far we are on schedule. Now, I hope it will last. I think it's fairly probable that the preparatory work will be completed. When I took on my job, I said sort of half jokingly that what I'll try to do is to make sure that if MU doesn't happen, it will not be because the technical preparations will not have been achieved. And I think that objective is probably going to be achieved. Now, let me come to the essence of my presentation. First, how do I look at the benefits of MU? I would rate as one of the first benefits of MU is the realistic expectation that monetary union will ensure lasting price stability. Now, this the price stability is laid down in the Maastricht Treaty as the primary objective of the single monetary policy, and that objective is incorporated in the statutes of the participating central banks. At the same time, the European system of central banks will enjoy full independence to determine the appropriate level of interest rates in order to satisfy the requirement of the treaty. Moreover, the members of the ECB, of the executive board, and the governors of the participating central banks will have long terms of office, and therefore they will be entirely safe, and they have the ability to carry out their specific and extremely clearly defined mandate. Now, this, I think, this legal framework makes it very likely that they will be, in fact, be capable of achieving what they are supposed to achieve, and that means that they would be able to consolidate the results which have already been achieved in terms of achieving the price stability. Now, we know, I think, at least that's my understanding, that price stability is an important matter for the management of the economy. I think we have learned the lesson that trying to play with instability as we did in the 1970s produces results that we end up both with higher inflation and higher unemployment. And that's why I think that the consolidation of all the progress that has been made already, even prior to the Maastricht Treaty, is a very important effect. It does mean, to my mind, that even those countries who at present do not enjoy yet all the benefits of changed inflationary expectations, because they have a track record which is more recent in achieving price stability, will benefit from MU, because in terms of long-term interest rates, it would mean a decline in these interest rates, certainly in nominal terms, but I think also in real terms. Now, a second important effect of MU, to my mind, is that it removes the risk of serious real exchange rate misalignments. Now, these misalignments, I think, are a major headache. They are a major headache worldwide. We are seeing it all the time in relations with the dollar, yen, European currencies. But we have seen also the potentially damaging effects of that inside Europe, because there the damages are likely to be even greater, because we have a greater degree of integration among our economies. Now, this leads to difficulties in business planning, a misallocation of resources, but they may also trigger protectionist trends, and therefore they pose a threat to free trade. Remember all the noise made at the time when the Italian lira plunged a few years ago, and also when sterling declined. There were calls for protection. They didn't succeed, but there was a genuine danger in this respect. So I think the real exchange rate misalignments put really a risk at risk the good functioning of the single market. Because don't forget that we live now in a very special situation in Europe, which is an entirely new situation. On the one hand, we have had a very spectacular downward convergence in inflation rates. The average inflation rate is now down to something around 2.2%. That was the January figure, the average inflation rate in Europe. And at the same time, we have had the gradual implementation of the single market, which is much more than simply free trade or a customs union. The single market, which now moves into the area of services, means a generalized competition and a constant pressure of profit margins. Now, you put these two things together, the single market with great competition and a convergence of inflation rate, and this means that in this new world, even small changes in exchange rates transform themselves into real exchange rate misalignments with disruptive effects on trade flows and business planning. And this is that would be prevented by MU. Now, the third argument, of course, is that even short-term volatility of exchange rates can be cut out. I know that this doesn't seem to be considered as being a very damaging situation, because you can protect yourself against short-term exchange rate volatility. You can easily have the appropriate hedging, but don't forget that is not available for everyone, nor is it costless. So I do think that volatility has also a negative effect, and moreover, I think I pointed that out in my written text. I was quite struck by an argument put forward by David Curry in his recent paper, that when you have the appropriate hedging against one risk, you do not know what is happening with the other risks, and you may make your situation even worse. Now, finally, I would mention naturally the benefits of of economic integration, which would result once the single currency is implemented and not simply the exchange rates fixed, where of course you eliminate costs, cash management costs, commissions, bid offer spreads, and all the rest. Now, the cost of this is not insignificant, but I recognize it's not easy to measure. On the whole, I think the main argument I would sum up is that the single currency is the natural completion of the single market, that it would be very difficult to draw all the advantages from a single market without a single currency, and to put it quite simply, you may put at risk the existence of the single market if you do not have a single currency. Let me come now to some of the criticisms of EMU, which are of importance. I think one should regard the potential costs with seriousness. One cannot disregard them. And this is what I try to do now in this introductory presentation. But I think if I rightly understand, the main policy or even political argument put forward against EMU is that it entails the loss of monetary sovereignty, i.e. the ability to use monetary policy to achieve domestic objectives. But my feeling is that this argument only retains force in countries if countries were to disagree on the final objective of monetary policy. But instead, there has been a growing consensus over the last decade or more that monetary policy cannot influence economic activity and unemployment beyond the short term. This has been the result of the experience of the 70s to which I referred. And this has led now to an intellectual and political conversion to the cause of price stability and to worldwide acceptance of its primary objective of monetary policy. Now, at the European Union level, since monetary policies have a common objective, and given the potential for spillover of national policy decisions in this area, I find it hard to see what is lost by sharing responsibility for the conduct of the single monetary policy, which is, in essence, what EMU means. I might add that the degree to which countries may adopt fully independent national monetary policies is itself limited by the power of the international financial markets, whose ability to punish perceived monetary laxity with rising bond yields or high bond yields and a falling currency has strengthened in recent years. So I don't take this argument very seriously, but I'm quite sure we are going to have a debate on this. But there are other arguments which, to my mind, carry certainly some weight. First, there will clearly be costs to the changeover, such as training, updating computer systems, adjustment to cash dispensers, and so on and so forth. But these are one-off costs which should be weighed against certain permanently accruing benefits. Second, there may be differential effects of a single monetary policy on national economies, owing to differences in the monetary transmission process. Now, this, I think, is of particular importance for this country, because the studies we have made show that there is not much difference in this respect on the continent, but there is a difference between the continent and the UK to a very large extent, because the generalized use of variable short-term interest rates rather than long-term interest rates. But I think that in the long run, once EMU is effectively operating, then with sustained low inflation, then long-term interest rates will come back and these national differences are likely to diminish. Now, I think the strongest argument and I'd like to dwell on this for a minute. Against establishing MU, that is the strongest to my mind, is that individual countries should retain the ability to change the exchange rate as a means of responding to adverse asymmetric shocks. Shocks which affect the domestic economy, but not the euro area as a whole. One preliminary remark, however, I do not believe that asymmetric shocks are likely to be frequent events in Western Europe. First, our economies remain rather similar in structure and are relatively diversified, certainly in comparison with the United States. What I have in mind is to take the example of the automobile industry. The automobile industry plays an important role in practically all our individual countries. It is very heavily concentrated in the United States in some areas. And you can repeat that with a number of other arguments. There are, of course, regional differences in countries, but between the countries, the structures in Europe are remarkably similar and diversified. Second point I'd like to make is that whenever we had in the past a genuine asymmetric shock, and I would like to point out clearly German unification was one, and to a lesser extent the oil shock. What really mattered at that time was not so much the asymmetric nature of the shock, but the asymmetry of the policy reactions. I mean, that was quite clear in the case of the oil shock, where countries were divided really into groups reacting to the oil shock. And if you come to the German situation, what is also clear that if the Germans had at that time not implemented a major increase in the public sector borrowing requirement, which amounted to a jump of several percent of GDP, the impact on interest rates would have been totally different. And probably the Germans today, with the kind of stability culture they themselves have acquired regarding the budgetary policies, the fiscal policies, would react today in a different way. Now, I do not deny, however, that there can be asymmetric shocks. I don't think that they will be very frequent or very important, but they could be. And I do share concerns about market rigidities in this respect, because, of course, one way of dealing with asymmetric shock is to have flexibility in the goods, services, and in particular in the labor market. And there is no doubt in my mind that, in particular, on the European continent, more than in this country, we have inadequate flexibility in the labor market. Where I disagree with the argument is that I do not believe that this is an argument against EMU. The source of the problem lies in the structural rigidities that prevent timely adjustment in domestic prices and wages, and the reduction of such rigidities, especially in labor markets, is an objective which has to be pursued irrespective of monetary union. Now, keeping the exchange rate option open, which means, to put it bluntly, the devaluation option open, may even foster the illusion that structural adjustments do not require immediate attention. Moreover, in an environment of real labor market rigidities, changing the nominal exchange rate may not be effective against shocks. If real wage decline is needed to prevent a negative shock from raising unemployment, it has to be the case that wage setters are prepared to allow it through a depreciation of the national currency, but at the same time are not willing to accept it through nominal wage restraint. Now, this presupposes a kind of monetary money illusion which I don't think is prevalent any longer in most of our countries. Finally, A word about fiscal policy. I think it is true to say that MU does not provide the possibility for large-scale fiscal transfers between member states of a magnitude that would be sufficient to offset entirely differences in labour market rigidities. Moreover, we now have also the Stability Pact, which limits the possibility of increasing indebtedness, thanks God. But don't forget that even within the Stability Pact, if countries aim and achieve structural deficits of zero over time, that would still leave the possibility for changes in effective fiscal positions to be able to cope with some of these asymmetric external shocks. Now, the final points I'd like to make is about how can we ensure that the net benefits are achieved. But I think there are basically two requirements. The one is that we ensure a genuinely sustainable convergence among our countries before entry into MU, and second, in the longer term, to achieve enhanced labour market flexibility. The first point. The dangers of a lack of convergence when countries enter MU are self-evident. If fiscal positions are not initially under control, there may be repercussions on the single monetary policy from large deficits and adverse spillovers across borders affecting the monetary union as a whole from lax fiscal policies in individual member states. Now, these difficulties are far from theoretical, because we must be aware that with such a unique enterprise as MU, with no historical precedent and operating in an uncertain world environment, we will have to live with the possibility of teething troubles during the crucial running-in period of MU, during the first years, which could put considerable strain on the strategy and the technical capability of the European Central Bank. Now, such strain could become unbearable, or, to put it less dramatically, could lead to a dangerously unbalanced policy mix if it were compounded by the consequences of initially weak budgetary positions in member countries. Now, the authors of the treaty were aware of these dangers and therefore required entrants to show a high degree of sustainable convergence by reference to compliance with various convergence criteria. And my institute is assigned an important role in the assessment of such performance. Now, given the crucial importance of the issue, let me outline how I would like to see the EMI's advice on the eventual assessment of fiscal positions being given. In essence, I believe we should stick to both the spirit and the letter of the treaty. And the treaty says three things and not one. Firstly, it establishes the so-called reference values, which should not be exceeded, the 3% deficit ceiling and the 60% debt ceiling. Secondly, however, it accepts deviations from these reference values on certain conditions, which are described rather carefully, but not quantified. Thirdly, it insists on the need to have sustainable positions. In fact, it uses this expression twice to cover all the convergence criteria, inflation, exchange rates, interest rates, and in addition, it refers specifically to the sustainability of budgetary positions. Now, given the risks which I think we run at the beginning, I reach two conclusions from this. First, deviations from the reference values should be granted sparingly by interpreting the words used by the treaty in a carefully restrictive way. And second, compliance with the reference values should be regarded as sufficient for eligibility only if the deficit and debt ratios observed for 97 are genuinely sustainable. In short, in case of doubt, when applying the second and third prescription of the treaty, we should lean towards caution. Now, these are how I see the recommendations to be made by my own council. As you know, the decision will be taken by the heads of state and government. That will be a political decision, and they are free to decide. Of course, they have to abide by the treaty, and they have to take into account the advice we give and the advice given by the Commission. But what the final choice will be, I do not know. Now, beyond convergence, I consider that the greatest challenge that most of our countries face, as I said already, is in the labor market. I've already noted that wage and price flexibility is essential to facilitate adjustment to various kinds of shocks that may hit individual EU economies from time to time. With or without EMU, employment policies have to be in the forefront of attention of European policymakers. The recent record of the Union in terms of job creation is dismal. Employment has barely risen in the Union as a whole since the cyclical trough in 1993, and projections envisage little improvement. Now, this points to the crucial need for continued labor cost moderation and enhanced labor market reforms across the EU. It is evident that the recovery of output growth alone will be insufficient to remedy deep-seated structural patterns of unemployment. But let me conclude by saying that I think the preparations for EMU are far advanced. In combination with the strong political commitment to go ahead with EMU and with the remarkable downward convergence of inflation rates, this has led to enhanced, although volatile, expectations in financial markets that EMU will come about. I believe that EMU will lead to major benefits for participants, although I do not want to disregard potential costs. Now, to minimize these costs and therefore to ensure large and lasting net benefits for countries entering the monetary union, these countries should be in a state of sustainable macroeconomic convergence and should be ready to improve the working of their labor markets as well as to reduce the often very substantial indirect labor costs. This is needed anyhow if they are to achieve the reduction of what I regard as unacceptable current levels of unemployment. But thank you for your attention. These are my introductory remarks. And now they can be taken into pieces by the panel.
Well, thank you very much for that very elegant and eloquent speech. Can I now turn over to David Marsh, who is going to briefly introduce our discussants and, more important, control them, because we'd like to allow a certain amount of time for discussion from the floor from about 7 o'clock to 7:15, and we'd like to try to finish by 7:15. David.
Yes, thank you, Anthony. Well, in fact, my job is really very simple. It is to introduce the discussants and to initiate debate and to maintain it, including with the participation of you, the audience. And in fact, these four very distinguished people that we have assembled here today, they do not need much introduction, which is why I'm not going to give them very much, because this also means that we'll have more time for the essential elements of the debate. They are all household names, and they all very great authorities in their different ways on the EMU process. So I'm going to introduce them simply in the sequence in which I'm going to ask them to speak, and this does not denote any order of preference for their views. The first discussant will be Mr. Bill Cash. The second will be Mr. Giles Radici, representing the two sides of the House of Commons, the government and the opposition. The third will be Professor Charles Goodhart from the London School of Economics. And our fourth discussant will be Christopher Haskins, chairman of Northern Foods. So I'll start straight away asking Bill Cash to speak. As Anthony has said, we do aim to finish by about 7:15 at the latest. Bill and Giles do need to leave a little bit early because of a commitment at the House of Commons. So I'm going to ask you all, please, to keep your opening remarks to no more than 5 minutes.
Well, thank you very much indeed. Is this working? Can you hear?
Wait a minute. To speak nearer to it.
You have to get closer to it.
Is that any better?
No.
If you put your mouth very near it, it works.
Yeah, I might eat it. How's that? All right? Fine. Well, my first concern is, in listening to Mr. Lamafluzi, is that, of course, he's talking about monetary union, economic policy, and nowhere does he really deal with the question of political union, because the real objective of monetary union is political union, and you can't separate one from the other. The second thing I would say is that when you actually come to look at the results, for example, of the promises that have been made on the economic side alone since the inception of these concepts in a within the legal framework and the acquis communautaire, then of course one has to look at things such as one market, one money, the Caccini report, the experience of the exchange rate mechanism, and so forth, which, in a word, has been a disaster. That has been reflected in the levels of unemployment which are now being generated throughout Europe as a result of this drive towards political union on the back of specious policies which have not been delivered with respect to economic union. And indeed, I would have been accused of scaremongering or of being in some way exaggerating about 5 or 7 years ago, and indeed I was when I predicted that this would happen, and of course it has happened, and therefore I fall back on hard economic evidence, such as, for example, the unemployment levels in Germany, which are not entirely and exclusively the consequence of the reunification. And indeed, the knock-on effect with respect to France, and indeed, I would look also at the unemployment level in Spain and elsewhere in the community, except, of course, the levels of unemployment in the United Kingdom, which are now running at only 7.6% as compared to the 13% in Germany, etc., under this extremely unhappy regime, which is not only being proposed, but is being developed. Now, I would also say that the basis of the argument is, and largely turns, for economic and monetary union on the prospects for price stability. But, of course, you can't have price stability if it isn't even defined, and the Maastricht Treaty doesn't define what it is. The second point is that it has been proved by the difficulties that the labour market is in within Europe, that it isn't working. Let me look, for example, at the relative job creation in the United States, 31 million in the last 20 years, as compared to the European Union, 1 million. Now, that is a pretty remarkable distinction and is tied up with what Mr. Lamafluzi quite rightly paid attention to, but which the European politicians refuse to even attend to, which is the problem of the labour markets and flexibility. We do not have mobility within Europe, and indeed I don't believe we will get it, for a whole range of political reasons I haven't got time to go into, but you know them for yourself. It's partly language, but it's also a whole range of other political questions. The second thing is that there is an absolute determination to sustain the social chapter, and indeed, for that matter, the fact that the United Kingdom is not a member of it, if there were to be a Labour government, is not to suppose that we wouldn't then be inflicted with all the other incidents of it which haven't yet been brought in. It gets right to the heart of the kind of political Europe that one country, which Karl Lammers refers to, which is at the heart of these problems. Secondly, the bankers themselves under the ECSB cannot guarantee either price stability or that their arguments will work. Indeed, I'll go further and say that all the evidence is it hasn't been working and it has been hurting, so that we need have no confidence that giving them independence would give any degree of certainty to improvement in economic growth and performance. Furthermore, and I'll rapidly go through these last few points, it is certainly so that if you can provide no guarantee, and the bankers themselves certainly couldn't, then it follows that there is no guarantee that the single currency regime would function efficiently. And if it didn't, with the massive unemployment levels that the deflationary policies of Maastricht criteria would imply and have already been proved to occur, then we could have, and I believe will have, massive implosion politically, which within a legal framework which would be extremely dangerous politically without the national safety valves and the national parliaments to whom the people could look and turn them out. Then there is also the fact that I think the euro itself would be extremely weak and would be liable to massive speculation internationally, which I think is another very grave disadvantage. And in a nutshell, the prospects with enlargement are that you get a multiplicity of problems which are already generated and which have driven people back to a hard core. A hard core is not a European Union. A hard core is not a European community. It is effectively, and I think I can fairly quote Karl Lammers and indeed Chancellor Kohl and others in this respect, it is in German national interest to achieve a situation in which German national interests and European integration of the kind that they wish to propose, which they would feel comfortable with, are in German national interests and not in the interests of Europe as a whole. I therefore personally entirely repudiate the idea that you will gain economic or political benefits from this proposal. With many other things I could touch on, but I think enlargement itself is at risk under these proposals. If you had a looser, more flexible arrangement, not tied into this crazy acquis communautaire, which is based on paper constitutions, which cannot or will not work, then I think we are heading for a very serious disaster. The political environment has changed substantially in Europe. The individual nation states are themselves marching with their feet against it. Our problem is not the feet of the people of Europe, it is the minds of the political elite. And the quicker we renegotiate this entire process, the better. And I say that with great respect to Mr. Mamafluisi and to all the other congregated bankers throughout the whole of the European Union. It is time for Europe to wake up from this ridiculous dream. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. I thought you were talking about Mr. Rabelaisian or something like that towards the end. Well, thank you very much for your spirited intervention. We're actually converging quite nicely around a performance of 6.5 minutes, so let's try to keep to that particular criterion. Giles, who of course is also chairman of the European Movement, what do you say to that?
Well, firstly, I'd like to thank Mr. Lamfalusi for his excellent speech. And I want to say straight away that I believe there are strong arguments in principle for a single European currency. I believe it would be good for the citizens of Europe in a very obvious kind of way, because you would not have the cost of changing money, which you presently get if you're travelling from one country to another. So that is a plus. Secondly, it's good for exporters, because transaction costs amount at the moment to a trade tax of about $3 billion a year. And that's especially hard for small businesses who can't get into the business of hedging and find it a disincentive to export. And I believe with Mr. Lamfalusi that it's a natural extension of the single market. And it was Helmut Schmidt who said that whoever heard of a single market with 11 currencies, and it's certainly the case that currency instability can and will threaten the future of the single market, which, contrary to what Bill Cash has said, has actually brought enormous benefits to Europe and to Britain as well. But the main economic argument for a single currency is that it would bring economic stability. I don't believe that it is an engine for deflation and unemployment. On the contrary, it's often blamed, it's often said that. I mean, this is what Bill Cash was saying. But if you look at German unemployment, that it is largely related to two factors. Firstly, to unification, the fact they took over a basket economy and are now transforming it. And secondly, that they have very high non-wage costs as part of the structure of the way they pay for their social benefits. And they've got to look at that, and they are doing so. But that's got very little to do with EMU or anything else. And France has somewhat similar problems. I believe that a EMU would bring lower interest rates across Europe. It would be particularly helpful to us because we have higher interest rates than France and Germany. It would allow more growth and therefore would mean more investment and more jobs. It has been estimated that the impact of the single currency could, for Britain, mean an annual net gain of 0.5% on our GDP, which over 10 years would amount to 40 billion extra in resources. And I believe, too, that it's good for the whole European economy. It would provide an incentive, a spur to growth, which we've lacked in recent years. Now, as to the political issue, the issue of Germany, I don't believe this was ever a German policy. If anything, it was a French policy, because the French wanted European monetary policy not to be dominated by the Bundesbank. They wanted some purchase over it, and that was why it came about in the first place. So it's quite wrong to think of this as a blueprint for German domination. On the contrary, it's actually supplanting the rule of the Bundesbank with the rule of a European Central Bank. And I believe that by linking countries together in this way, the single currency would certainly prevent us ever going to war again, at least I hope it would. Now, will it go ahead? David Marsh has been a long-term prophet of doom. He said that it wouldn't happen on time, and I see he's saying it again.
But that's not a doom scenario, Giles.
Well, I'm glad it isn't. I noticed that Gavin Davis in today's Independent thinks it's still more likely than not, on the basis of the Goldman Sachs forecast of the German and French economies, and they do see a growth between 2 and 2.5%, which would bring both France and Germany within reach of the deficit criteria. Now, the question is, if it does go ahead, should we join? I believe that sooner or later we should join. I think the costs for us of staying out would be very high, would mean higher interest rates. We've already heard from companies like Toyota, Rover and Siemens of the worries that they have if we remained out forever of a single currency. And I believe it would be a loss of economic and political influence for the United Kingdom. So I think we're absolutely right to keep the option open of joining. And if we can't join in the first wave, then we should join as soon as possible afterwards. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank our two MPs for getting us off to such a cracking start. Also, I should say that we'd like, of course, Professor Lamfalussy, for you to say few words in response. I might ask you a question when we've got to the end of our four discussants. But now, Charles Goodhart, who's invented a famous law about when a statistic becomes the subject of a measurement, it no longer is relevant. Perhaps we're all looking at the wrong subject with monetary union.
Well, like Bill Cash, I believe that the political balance between benefit and cost is much more important than the economic balance. I think, unlike Bill, I have a very, very great sympathy for what monetary union is trying to achieve. The cementing the rapprochement between France and Germany and moving to a more appropriate balance of sovereignty between federal, national, and regional strikes me as an entirely appropriate. The concentration that we have had of powers in this country at Westminster strikes me as wildly overdone, almost a form of electoral dictatorship which does not benefit the UK citizen, and some sharing of powers both upwards and downwards strikes me as highly desirable, with all due respect to my MP colleagues. The problem and the dangers and the costs that I see in this are also primarily political and arise from the fact that the sequencing of the whole exercise is extraordinary and unique. When you come to almost any monetary change of regime, monetary unification, monetary dissolution, and we've had loads of all of those, the sequence has always been you get the political change first. This then usually leads on to a fiscal shift, and finally the monetary change comes at the end of the day. And I think the reasons for that are fairly straightforward, which are that the monetary unification will undoubtedly lead at some time and some places to occasions where parts of the monetary union do get a relatively rough deal because they cannot adjust. If there is not the political cement and cohesion, and if there isn't the fiscal support from the other parts of the union, it is very likely that it will or might politically break up. And the real dangers of EMU, once it gets going, and nothing to do with technical problems at the ECB. I mean, economics professors like Alexandre, and even, dare I say, myself, could run the ECB without great difficulty. The problem is actually making...
Are you applying for the job?
I hope I wouldn't be in the running for it. There will be some asymmetric shocks, and Alexandre is right. The north-central countries are more similar than the parts of the United States. But you might just note en passant that if we do come to monetary union, it's quite likely that we would get specialization within even the north-central part of Europe that would make us mimic the US in that respect in due course. And even now, other parts of the union, the Scandinavian countries, the UK and Ireland and some of the Mediterranean countries are not as closely similar as the United States. And if we do get these asymmetric shocks, there is likely to be the development of political parties within the those regions or countries which are suffering, where rightly or wrongly their sufferings or relative sufferings will be blamed on the fact that they have given up, to some large extent, their ability to adjust. Now, there is this debate within Europe between the monetarists, and I don't mean the Chicago monetarists, and the economists, where the monetarists see monetary union coming first before political union as actually forcing the pace and therefore helping us to move forward to a greater European Union faster. And some of that you will see in Alexandre's paper, in his argument that, yes, we don't have wage rigidity, but by golly, if we have European Union, we'll have to move to wage flexibility quicker. In the argument that, yes, we can't have stabilization under the Vagel Pact very easily at the moment, but if only the countries could move to a balanced budget, then they would be able to stabilize themselves. The difficulty is that all these are hopes, and they haven't yet occurred. And without the political cement, without fiscal support, the one for the other, what I would fear is that, I'd say the UK was in, and say that the UK unemployment started to rise quite sharply, for whatever reason, nothing to do with the European Union. You would get lots and lots of politicians, indeed Bill Cash would be among them, who would be making speeches that effectively would say, if only you get out of this straitjacket, I can resolve your problems. And I think that those speeches would in fact play very well among very large audiences, and that would endanger the political and the continuing monetary stability of a European monetary union. And so perhaps my last suggestion would be that if the our continental friends want to make a really good go of European Monetary Union, they should try and assure themselves that the UK is not a part of it.
Well, thank you, Charles. As always, shaded with delicate tones of irony. Now, for our final discussant, a man whose head should really be on the euro banknotes because he appears on so many programmes and discussions about monetary union, Chris Huskins, the voice of reason, the voice of business from Northern Foods.
Thank you very much, David. David's document intrigued Chris. Me. This way. Which way?
Well, you can.
That one better. Yeah. Yes. David's document, which he carefully circulated to us 3 or 4 days in advance, intrigued me, because you have 3 or 4 different approaches to this matter in this country and indeed in Europe. First of all, you've got a lobby which is the wishful thinking lobby. Hope it'll all go away. David sometimes is in that, sometimes he isn't that. Secondly, there is German angst, now becoming quite a serious matter in Germany. Everybody's getting pretty angst about the whole thing. David's certainly in that. Thirdly, you have British neurosis, which you find in the columns of the, what I call the Manchester Guardian, other people call the Guardian, and the Observer on Sundays, very traditional of the soft left. And fourthly, you have the arrogance of the, to put it mildly, of the political right. And finally, you have the sensible, pragmatic approach people might leave me keep putting forward. There seem to be 5 options facing us. First of all, a successful EMU with Britain in. Secondly, a successful EMU without Britain in. Those two I want to pursue. The other 3, a failed EMU, I think we'd have to recognise is a disaster for everybody, including Britain. A postponed EMU, in my view, raises the question of the danger of a meltdown of the whole process. And no EMU at all creates the high risk of a meltdown of the whole European process. From the business point of view, the case for EMU is pretty overwhelming. Our trade with Europe is growing rapidly. Now nearly 60% of our manufacturing trade is with Europe. The single market has been a good idea for British industry. It was signed with quite a lot of enthusiasm by Mrs. Thatcher, who actually agreed to an extension of the courts by so doing, which was a greater undermining of sovereignty than anything that is in the present process of EMU. And the single market, however, does need further tackling. There is still too much protectionism. EMU will help further to undermine that protectionism. The EMU itself will create a climate of low interest rates, which has bedeviled this country for 50 years. Our interest rates, long-term interest rates, still are 1 to 1.5% points above most of our OECD competitors. That will end with EMU, and we will at last get back to doing the thing that has bedeviled our economy for the last 50 years, which is to raise our level of investment. I'm amazed that liberal capitalists find the concept of EMU hostile. From their point of view, all those principles of a free market, of less protectionism, of more free trade, should be exactly what the liberal capitalists want. Not so sure about my friends in the Observer. The depoliticising of interest rates is something that even Mr. Lamont agrees is a good idea. He thinks perhaps going to Frankfurt is too far, but the principle of an independent bank, central bank, goes along with that. My company, as a result of the strength of sterling in the last 12 months, has lost £20 million, totally unnecessary. Next year it might make £7 million. I don't mind. That is not a climate for sensible long-term investment. There are 4 criticisms of EMU which need to be dealt with. First of all, the fact that it undermines our economic sovereignty. Our economic sovereignty was undermined in Bretton Woods and undermined further in 1971 with the deregulation of global markets. We no longer have economic sovereignty. And when the Chancellor of the Exchequer, in response to a question, says that I cannot control the level of the currency, he's speaking the truth, and we should recognise that. As far as political sovereignty is concerned, it disappeared in Casablanca in 1943 when we handed over the running of the war to the Americans. We did. We formally recognised that by signing up with NATO in 1948. We had the last rather absurd go at proving our masculinity in 1956 at Suez, and we got our deserts there. The issue of national political sovereignty for every country in the world, except perhaps the United States, is dead. The social chapter, of which I know a little bit about, has got nothing whatever to do with EMU, nothing at all to do with EMU. And if you possibly read the social chapter, you'll find that it is full of aspirations, dangerous aspirations, like more employment, like less discrimination in the workplace, like more health and safety in the workplace, like more consultation in the workplace. These aren't exactly life-threatening challenges to British industry. And if you ask the majority of British industry what they think about the social chapter, they say, we're not concerned about it. Of course, if the social chapter was used as a basis to transfer bad labour practices from elsewhere in Europe to here, that would be a concern. But the bad labour practices which exist in Germany can be traced back to Bismarck, in Spain can be traced back to Franco, and in France back to dear old Napoleon. They're nothing to do with EMU and nothing to do with the European Union. The final point, therefore, is if EMU succeeds, and I think it will, and we as a country stay out, where are we going to be left? Well, clearly sterling is going to be much more exposed than it is at the present time. If it is exposed, then the counter to that is high interest rates, and the counter to that is less investment in this country and fewer jobs. We will, unfortunately, because of our links with Europe, have to track the euro currency, follow the euro currency, and be in line with euro policy without having any influence whatsoever about what's happening in the central bank. Inward investment, we understand, as what has been said, will decline. Outward investment will change too. My company supplies Marks & Spencer with food all the way across Europe. We're supplying that from British factories. We want to continue to supply it from British factories. If we are dealing with the additional difficulty of an extra currency factor, then there will be a temptation for us to build our factories in the future in France and not in Britain. We will get no support from the US outside EMU. We will get contempt rather than support. Even outside EMU, it is in Britain's interest that EMU succeeds. We cannot renegotiate the Treaty of Rome as one country out of 15. The concept of joining EFTA, the concept of joining Switzerland, which is on the verge of joining at any rate, of Norway, of Singapore, and somebody said poor, lamented, over-pressurized Canada, that is an example of the way we should go. That is utter nonsense. The logical position for those who are against EMU, if EMU succeeds, is withdrawal from the European Union. You will maintain the momentum of European and British political and economic prosperity and peace, and I support that proposition.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Yes, I think you've got the floor with you there. In fact, thank you for mentioning Casablanca. It's the first time I ever thought that Humphrey Bogart might be the new president of the European Central Bank. Before we go on to questions from the floor, I wonder whether we might give Alexander Lamfalussy the opportunity to say a few words. I wondered if I might also just make a reflection and put a question on the stature of the European Central Bank. It seems so obvious from everything that you have said and everything that our discussants have said that on these men and a few women running the show in Frankfurt will be vested an enormous amount of influence, an enormous amount of power, an enormous amount of responsibility. Having seen these people in operation for the last 20 years, you have been uniquely positioned to actually see cheek by jowl how your colleagues from the central banking fraternity actually operate over the last 20 years. And having seen that the world has not run all that smoothly in those 20 years with these people, their hands on the lever, are you confident that we should entrust this central bank with this enormous power to this body of extremely intelligent, unelected, rather anonymous technocrats?
My answer is yes, but let me come back to that in a minute.
That's what I thought you'd say.
Yes, I would like just to say two words on two different topics. One, the link between Maastricht and unemployment. I do not think that there is any really strong or sizable link. Just to remind us, unemployment started rising in Europe in the early 1970s. You look at any graph, and it is a straight line going up, which started rising and accelerating at a time when no one even heard about Maastricht. That is the historical development. Second point, just one example of one country, and that's the Netherlands. Now, the Dutch guilder has been even stronger than the Deutschmark. They have been living in monetary union with Germany. Their unemployment has been going down. That of Germany has been going up. And that does suggest that unemployment has causes which have not much to do with monetary union or with the strength of the currency or with the lack of monetary autonomy. It has to do with the fact that the Dutch had agreed among themselves on the basis of a very strong consensus in the early 1980s to limit wage costs as a basic proposal in order precisely to fight unemployment, which was at that time much higher than it is today. Moreover, they have introduced elements of flexibility in their system which does not exist in Germany. So, I mean, that shows that there is a genuine homemade problem in most of our countries, which is the source of unemployment. Now, the second remark I'd like to make concerns the political union part. I think this is a very serious argument. I didn't go into it because that's not part of my job. And I'm not going to talk as president of the monetary of the European Monetary Institute in this respect, but as a Belgian citizen. Well, I do recognize with Charles Goodhart that historically political unification came first normally, and monetary union came as the end of the whole process. Well, that's clearly not the case of today. Now what to say about this argument? I mean, the first point I'd like to make is that one has to be very careful when using the word political union. Charles, you used the word in terms of political change, rather. You were careful not to talk about political union, but still the implication is that. I think we have to be very careful about that, because what is needed for EMU to function is the coherence of a certain number of economic policies. That concerns certainly fiscal policies. It concerns the fact that we take care of our domestically caused labor problems. It does not mean that we give up our national identity. There is a very effectively functioning single monetary policy in Switzerland, yet there are differences between the cantons in their way of life, which are much bigger than differences between many of our countries. I mean, no one questions national identity, the fact that you can speak your own language, that you have your own educational system. I mean, these are the cultural values, which are the very essence of national identity. These are not questioned. What are questioned are the ways in which our economy functions. And there I entirely agree with Mr. Huskins that kind of national independence is in the process of disappearing, whatever happens to Maastricht. It has disappeared, in fact, for most of our countries. But we can preserve our cultural identities, which is of essence. So that is just one remark. Now the second remark is that then Charles Goodhart said, all right, you agree that you need changes in the way in which we operate our economic policies, but you say that will happen, but this is hope. This is not reality. Well, of course it is hope, but there are changes underway in Europe which I think justify this hope. Please consider what has happened in the area of inflation. No one would have foreseen 10 years ago, let alone 5 years ago, that we have achieved an effective convergence in inflation rates. Europe was divided, basically divided, as regards inflation a few years ago. It is not any longer. That is a massive change. As regards the our fiscal problems, problems concerned with the financing of the social security, all these are very similar problems and are identified by almost everyone as being very similar. I'm not saying that the reactions to solving them are already entirely similar, but they are moving in the same direction. And I think this is the result of economic integration. So there is a process underway which is not simply hope. Now, for the end, the last the question about the unelected technocrats.
Yes, the Bill Cash has to go, I'm afraid, now. But
as much I can say in reply to many of these things said, that I should afraid I should have to go.
It's a shame.
We'll read it in your next column.
Now, the I think the basic point is that the European Central Bank will have a mandate. They are not given the right to carry out a monetary policy according to their whims. They have a mandate which is extraordinarily constraining mandate. They have to carry out a monetary policy in order to achieve price stability. And this is something which is not an open mandate. They have to achieve a result. Now, they have to explain themselves how they do it and why they do it. They have to go public. The president of the European Central Bank will have to sign a report both to the European Council and to the European Parliament. He will have to testify in hearings, just in the way Mr. Greenspan is testifying, explaining why they are doing it, how they are doing it. This is a sort of accountability. Now, the only thing that is missing, but, and I'm not saying that as a joke, is the possibility of a sanction. I think it would have been conceivable, but I don't think that that was really considered in the Maastricht Treaty to link the salaries of the members of the executive board of the European Central Bank to the rate of inflation, but in a reverse, in reverse. I mean, that could have been a good idea. Perhaps it's still feasible.
Thank you for these really scrupulously fair remarks, and also for your remarks earlier on, which are really extremely balanced and I think a hugely useful contribution to the debate. The debate now we do intend to open to the floor. I feel sure that there will be questions put to our panel which touch upon some of the points which Alexander Lamfalussy made. There are only three requirements, really. Firstly, that you should speak very clearly and loudly. Secondly, that you should tell us, please, who you are. And thirdly, if you do have a point to put to an individual member of the panel, you should say to whom that is addressed. So please, you, sir, first of all. Could
more
you speak
loudly,
a bit
please, if possible.
Thank you.
Yes, well, I'm never 100% sure of anything, but I would say that the risk is very high indeed. The risk is very high indeed, and that's why I am very much against postponement.
Would anybody else like to say anything about that? Giles.
Well, I think that we've had a lot of speculation in our press about postponement. Presumably, partly because it would suit British interest if it was postponed. But I think the danger is I haven't been convinced by any of the mechanisms for postponement that it wouldn't actually just lead to the whole process being derailed and for a major setback to confidence in European currencies generally by the markets.
Could it not suit Tony Blair if he is the next Prime Minister, Giles?
Well, it might suit Tony Blair, but he mightn't have an enterprise to join.
Please. Well, it seems a very complicated question. Perhaps, Mr. Lamfalussy, you could give us your views, not, of course, as the prospective ECB president, but somebody who will be basking in retirement by that time.
Yes, well, I don't know that I say thanks God, but I would like to react just to one question, and that is that concerns the impact of budgetary consolidation procedures on level of activity. I think that is a genuine problem. I think we all know that budgetary restraint may mean, in the short run, a dampening effect on activity. I mean, this is a sort of traditional Keynesian effect. But I do believe that the question of whether that will be the net result or not depends to a very large extent on the way it is done. Because the way it is done, triggers expectations in financial markets and can have a very serious and immediate effect on interest rates, downward effect on long-term interest rates, real interest rates, which can offset this Keynesian effect. And this is really the debate today, and I am in favor of achieving the Maastricht targets, because we need that anyhow. I mean, clearly, with the rising debt ratios which we have now in Europe for years, this is an unsustainable situation. But I would like to achieve that by attacking the root of the cause of the deficits, and that root, of course, is really at the heart of the matter. Now, this requires a very serious effort to deal with pension systems, healthcare, social security, and the level of taxation in general. Now, and if the budgetary consolidation is carried out in a way that gives a reasonable hope that these problems are effectively dealt with, then I do not think that we are going to have a Keynesian effect on our level of activity.
Just before we go to the next question, Charles Goodhart, quick comment on that.
Well, Alexandre is, of course, correct, and in fact you see that in some cases, and the Italian fiscal restraint is being offset by the fact that their interest rates have come down very sharply. But I would re-emphasize that it so much depends on the way that people perceive what is being done, and whether or not the unemployment in Europe is structural and nothing to do with EMU. The question is, what will people perceive that as being increasingly now and in future years? And if they perceive it as being due to EMU, whether or not it's not, there will be difficulties. And again, one of the points that you made in favor of EMU is that the single market couldn't really work unless you have a single currency. Now again, that's very largely a question of perception, and in this case particularly French perception. Because if you look at other free trade areas, for example NAFTA, there was no discussion whatsoever in getting the NAFTA area together that there needed to be a side agreement on relative currency movements. It's largely due to the beliefs and the perceptions of a large proportion of the Francophone economists that this argument has such strength. It is not a necessary factor.
Good, well, thank you. A questioner down here in the third row. Yes, that's your good self.
Should be speaking a bit more loudly,
more loudly, so the people upstairs can hear.
elephant trap.
Well, you want to be reassured in order not to create trouble. I mean, that's the...
Perhaps you'd like to go into a separate room and dial Chancellor Cole before answering that question.
I don't think that I want to enter into this debate at this stage.
Well, that's an extremely sound answer, I must say. I wouldn't want to either, I think, if I were you. I think the questioner has got a point, though, that there is a danger of self-fulfilling prophecies if people like Chancellor Cole go around saying that we have only one shot at this particular question, which to me is somewhat ahistorical. Then he does risk, as the questioner said, his prophecy of catastrophe coming about. But just before we go on to the next question, Chris Huskins, I don't know if you've got a sort of practical view here. I did notice in the Financial Times, which you mentioned already, there was a story in the Financial Times written coincidentally enough by my twin brother this morning, who's been going around interviewing lots of business people, very practical people like yourself, who all say that it would be a good thing in practice to have a single currency, but they are a bit worried about it coming too quickly. And those people don't seem to think that a delay would be a great catastrophe.
Yes, well, I mean, I saw the same article and I was pretty pleased with it. It actually showed that the majority of the, and there were small and medium term enterprises rather than the larger ones, but even in that group of people, the majority appeared to be in favour of EMU, but they had the neurotic tendencies that you have about not too quickly.
It could have been partly Hans Tietmeyer speaking, couldn't it?
I could, indeed. I was talking to the anonymous chairman of a German bank last Wednesday, and he said, when asked the question whether it would happen or not, that he gave the measurement at about 65-35. He said, as far as the banks are concerned, as far as business is concerned, it's 90-10. But as far as the general run of things, it's about 65-35, because he said there is quite a lot of, in Germany, public opinion concern building up at the present time. And there is obviously a political risk in that. My answer to that is that I suspect the German economy is doing rather better than other people think it is, and if it is doing better than other people think it is, that is good for this country, by the way. People who gloat about the German economy doing badly are misleading themselves. We want a strong German economy. I suspect that if the German economy strengthens, as I think it will do in the second part of the year, then the convergence criteria that are at the nub of this issue, that's what's at the nub of the issue, as to whether the Germans can achieve those convergence criteria, will be met, and EMU will start on time. If the convergence criteria cannot be met by Germany, Italy, or anybody, then I'm pretty confident that Herr Tietmeyer is going to make sure that the damn thing doesn't get off the ground anyway.
Thank you, Chris. Philip Hildebrandt.
Yes, just
Well, I think that would be a very dangerous game, because one of the main objectives of the Stability Pact is to ensure that the good habits gained by the need to comply with the criteria at the beginning are maintained during the first years of the monetary union in order not to put an unbearable pressure on monetary policy. See, that's the real danger with these with these deficits, and that's what I referred to. You see, that's where I would fear anything of the kind which looks respectable from an academic point of view would create really an environment in which it would be extraordinarily difficult to run a reasonable stability-oriented monetary policy, because you would have the financial market participants, perhaps you, consider that this is a sign of weakness. They would drive up long-term interest rates. In Europe, there would be a weakening of the euro, and then the monetary policy would have to be in a difficult situation, and we would end up in a monetary fiscal policy mix which would not be the best. And I think that's why I think it is of a major importance that we have the basic credibility that these consolidation processes remain on track. This is a lesser danger than the opposite.
Good. Well, I think that really does put the point. As always happens in the final 10 minutes, a veritable forest of arms is ascending. So I'm really going to take four questions which can all be bundled together before asking our panel to respond and then handing over to Anthony Giddens for a magisterial summing up. So I'd like four extremely short questions, please. First from the gentleman down there with the white hair in the fourth row. Can you stand up, because people can hear you more? Okay, thank you. The gentleman in the glasses and the rather nice open-necked sports shirt. It's actually good to see someone who might actually be doing a bit of studying, raising a question. Unlike the rest of us, we're all mature students. And then there was a gentleman with a rather nice red tie sitting right at the back. Yes, thank you, sir. Yes. That's one for Mr. Lamfalussy. And then there's the final person. Yes, you sir, with the glasses. Perhaps you could come to the front so people could hear you upstairs. Perhaps I'll ask Charles Goodhart to answer that final question first, and then we'll go on to the two other panellists who might have something to say briefly before giving the last word to Mr. Lamfalussy, which will also have to be rather brief, I'm afraid.
The difficulty of coming out of what has often been described as an irrevocable union are actually rather less than people have been allowed to realise. It's happened very frequently that you've had dissolutions of currency unions. It happened in former USSR, Yugoslavia. It's threatened to happen in Quebec. And indeed, there would be much less difficulty than in Quebec, because there you've got the problem of the Canadian debt and what is Quebec's share. It would be unpleasant and difficult, but essentially all you'd have to do is overstamp the euros with something called pound sign and off you go. It can be done quite easily, and if the political desire is to break up, the costs of breaking would not seem essentially very large if the political will to remain in was simply not there.
There could be a run on John Bull printing sets, I should imagine, in this eventuality. Giles, a few brief closing words from you.
I just say that, of course, this is a project which is difficult to achieve. Nobody doubts that. But I believe it will bring benefits for the whole of Europe and for the United Kingdom. And all I would say is that if it does go ahead, I very much hope that Britain does join soon after, because all my lifetime I've been watching Britain not joining projects and then having to go cap in hand and accepting all the other rules, the rules set down by other people, joining in the end. So for once it would be wonderful if we were actually part of the project, at least not at the very beginning, but soon after.
Chris, I once again call you the voice of reason, because you are such a reasonable chap.
Thank you very much indeed, David Wigg. I think the issue of irrevocability, that's what it's called, of EMU, or of the single market for that matter, hinges upon the fact when we actually signed the Treaty of Rome in 1973 or whenever it was. Because fundamentally that commitment was, for all intents and purposes, an irrevocable commitment. And I hold with that, I think, within the European movement, that that is the principle on which it's built, because the argument is, if it is not an irrevocable commitment, then Europe will sink back into all the political tensions and economic miseries which it had before the European movement got underway. So I think that this is a big step, EMU. I think we should approach it on the basis that it is irrevocable, that there isn't a way out of the thing, and I, for one, don't have any concern about that.
Thank you for a non-neurotic response. Mr. Lampolosi.
Yes, on stability, we have an agreement in my council to consider that price stability is a rate of inflation of 2% or slightly less. That is the objective which central banks are pursuing today, practically all of them, and which I think the European Central Bank is going to pursue. Now, I do not believe that the European Central Bank should have an exchange rate policy as such against the dollar or other currencies. I think its main task is to pursue domestic, i.e. euro area price stability, as I defined, and the rest should follow. Now, that may mean on occasion exchange market intervention. It may mean taking into account of what is happening with the external value of the currency, but that should come as a second after the pursuit of the domestic policy.
Good. Well, if I can, before just handing over to Anthony Giddens, just say one word of my own views. I am very much for a monetary union, provided it works. That might seem something of a truism. I do see a huge problem if Britain stays out and it does work. We might want to join, but wouldn't be able to. If we stayed out and it failed, we would be able to join, but we wouldn't want to. So that's a sort of paradox from the moderator to end my contribution. I'd like to hand over to Anthony Giddens and also say thank you again to the LSE for allowing us to put on this debate, which I've thoroughly enjoyed, and also, I dare say, I have learned something from this.
Well, could I say in conclusion, I've learned something too, but it's a pretty unenviable task to be asked to summarise such a debate. I was pleased to see that Mr. Lampolosi said he wasn't 100% sure of anything. I thought that was a sense of observation, actually, in the context of this debate, because if I can just briefly comment on the form of the debate rather than the substance of the debate, which has been adequately explored here, I think. Interesting feature of the debate about EMU is that completely contradictory positions are asserted with great confidence by both sides. And one might ask why that is possible. As I see it, there would presumably two reasons why this happens. One is that EMU is a marker. It's a symbolic and emotional marker, I think, for other phenomena besides the sheer economic element involved, and it conjures up a range of emotions which I think a debate like this ideally should try to cut through. Second, I think it is genuinely, even though it's approaching rapidly, it's genuinely hypothetical. I think even the most fervent supporter of EMU would have to accept that it's a risky enterprise. It's risky because it charts out territory which we haven't previously occupied. That's the reason, I take it, why both sides can say it's catastrophic on the one hand if we don't go in. If it doesn't happen, it's catastrophic if it does. It's an exploration, I think, of a new territory in the sense in which, as Charles pointed out, there haven't been many examples where monetary union has come before political union, and there's a complex of factors involved here. Certainly in the case of the United Kingdom, I think one can say that very important feature of the next few months will be elevating the debate about what the consequences of EMU will be, both in terms of its general consequences and the consequences for the UK if it goes ahead in its projected form. And I hope that this discussion has at least contributed to elevating that debate. I'd like to thank our main speaker, Mr. Lamassi, for an eloquent disquisition, and I'd like to thank also the commentators for, I think, not too brutal a response to it, but an informative one. And I'd like to thank the audience very much too, and Flemings for helping to co-sponsor this event. Thank you all very much.